Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shaudell, here on this beautiful Sunday morning with co-host and producer, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. And let's first thank our sponsor of the show, Fresh Fin Gourmet, who has come aboard in the past couple of weeks. Great company and very applicable to this time of year as we get ready for Christmas, Christmas Eve. And the Feast of the Seven Fishes.
Yeah, love those seven fishes.
So, again, welcome Fresh Fin Gourmet, officially known as freshfingourmet.com.
Officially known.
Fish. You got me.
See, I stunned you into silence.
You got me. So, but at any rate, you know, as we get into the holiday season, and I guess we're going to be talking about the holidays today.
Yeah.
We usually talk about 4th of July, you know, in October and something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, Fresh Fin Gourmet, they allow you to enjoy specialty seafood delivered directly to your home. So, again, us talking about it today allows you, our listeners, to go to the website, check out what they've got, and possibly shop and prepare for Christmas Eve.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, we should talk, you know, we'll touch on the seven fishes through the show here today because it's one of my favorite kind of meals to prepare. I do want it at what's the name of that restaurant I have in Matatuck? Amano. I do that at Amano when I remember. I mean, some years I forget, but no, I
and
do that.
And Shaudell is spelled S-C-H.
Yeah, S-C-H. Yeah, you gotta put the C in there. Anyway, so at Amano, I always do a Feast of the Seven Fishes on Christmas Eve, and it's always a lot of fun. And, you know, I'm a fish guy anyway. I mean, I've always had those restaurants that ended in fish, and it's my favorite thing to cook. And you might ask me, why is it your favorite thing to cook, Tom? Go ahead.
Why is it your favorite thing
to
cook, Tom?
I'll tell you, Stu. The reason I like cooking fish is because there are so many different varieties and all seasonal ingredients to pair with them. You know, different fish travel in schools in different times of the year in the Northeast here. And it's just this ever-changing palette of you know, flavors and preparations and stuff. So it's an awful lot of fun. And I think, you know, like beef, you know, I've been to a couple of steakhouses recently. Not that I don't eat really steak, but, you know, I grab an appetizer. I was at Capitol Grill the other night. I went to go to a Small Batch over in Garden City in Roosevelt Field. And for those of you who don't know Small Batch, it's a restaurant that's owned by Tom Colicchio. And you may know him from Top Chef fame if you've ever watched that show on I guess, on Bravo or whatever. He's the ball guy who's kind of the MC of it all. And he's a very nice man, very talented guy. I've met him on several occasions. He's a sweetheart of a guy and a good chef. And he has restaurants all over the country from here to Vegas to, I think, L.A. too, if I'm not mistaken. So he's doing very well. And he has this place called Small Batch in Garden City. And the food's real good there. And so I go there. I was meandering around on Monday night trying to find a place to go to have dinner. And I had to go up to the North Shore. And I just, you know, couldn't figure out where I wanted to go. I had to go back down towards Roosevelt Field because I had to pick up some stuff that I had ordered over there. And so let me go to Small Batch. But it turns out they closed on Monday and Tuesday, as is Marini, which is another restaurant in Roosevelt Field. And it's funny because it's the mentality of city guys. Both those restaurants are owned by city guys. And I don't think they really understand the lay of the land on Long Island. When you come out of the city, there's always that, you know, city mentality, and this is far from that. You know, it's a completely different animal out here.
I got to interject. I agree. It's real interesting. This Monday, Tuesday thing with restaurants has really thrown me for a loop.
Yeah.
I don't eat out that much, although I always talk about restaurants. But I know that when I get together with my mom, I try to get together with her a couple times a week or whatever. And even like, I think we talked about July 4th, which is a Monday, a celebration. Well, actually isn't always a Monday celebration, but I guess it was this year.
Yeah.
And I went to take out food from a restaurant that would normally be a perfect themed restaurant for 4th of July. And lo and behold, it was Monday and they were closed.
Yeah, yeah.
I know there's a couple of other restaurants in the South Shore area, Pastrami King, another restaurant that, you know, again, a Jewish holiday might be on Monday, and I want to get my potato latkes. No potato latkes for you.
Yeah, well, you know, the suburbs are different than the city. The city, you're kind of busy. 7 days a week until the summer comes, and then, you know, then everybody's off on the weekends.
But I'm really getting into this mentality. Actually, I'm looking out the window and the sun is shining. It's really cold, but the sun is shining.
Yeah.
But supermarkets, I don't, right here in Airport Plaza, we're fortunate to have a liquor store, which is Stu Leonard's, also a grocery store, Leonard's. But I'm used to my local Stop and Shop, which is here in town, and they're open till midnight.
Right.
The Lidl here in Farmingdale is open to 10. So when I wanted to go grab something the other night, when I was leaving the studio late, 9 o'clock, I go over to Stu Leonard's. They're closed. Mm. And it's like, whoa, that's crazy. And even, I guess, different Stop and Shops have different times. I was in Merrick on my way to visit Carrie, and I stopped there, and they close at 10 o'clock. I don't know if everybody else is in the same mentality that you're always out and about and have expectations of accommodations to your needs. But it just hit me that, like, you know, places close early here on Long Island sometimes.
Well, there are normal people that have normal hours. I mean, you're not normal.
I am far from normal. But this radio gig.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're far from normal, they can't even define what I am in a restaurant business, you know. But the bottom line is, I think that you can re-educate people and kind of re-engineer their hours by paring down. And it makes business sense a lot of times, you know. If you took a store the size of Stu Leonard's, I'm going to just take a guess here, that from, let's say, 7 o'clock at night till 10 or whatever they're open, they probably don't need a lot of employees. You need a couple of cashiers, one guy in the deli section, one guy in the fish section, and then, you know, maybe a security guy or one or two other people. You know, for a place that's probably 30,000 square feet, you know, for a restaurant that seats 40 people, you need more employees than that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it becomes this labor issue. And now, between the fact that you can't find them, you know, nobody wants to work, and the fact that help has become very expensive, everybody's kind of tightening the belt. And you do that when, you know, you close when it affects the least amount of people.
Yes, definitely. But what's interesting is nothing is simple, because take this Stu Leonard's closing at 9 o'clock.
Right.
So I go there. In the old days, they had this wonderful buffet, and they have a, let's call it a deli butcher section. So they would have short ribs and rack of ribs and stuff.
Right.
But if you go there, like, anywhere after 8 o'clock, like, the stuff is disappearing. And again, there's understood, just like you said, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes things.
Sure, yeah.
But, again... It's you know, if somebody's open to 9 o'clock, should they be full service to 9 o'clock? If you go to McDonald's at 9 o'clock, should they tell you, well, we don't got McFlurries and we got hamburgers but no fish fillets?
Yeah.
You know, but so again, if you look at things logically in the story you're going to share about, you know, the restaurateur and behind the curtain, oh my God, there must be so much to it, because I just go back to square one. How do you have enough food to appease everybody and not have too much that your filet mignon is becoming hamburger the next day?
Well, that's the alchemy of cooking in the restaurant business for the general public, because you don't know what they're going to order. You have no idea who's coming. You have no idea. I mean, you have reservations, but, you know, for a place like McDonald's, I mean, or a place like deli, you don't know who's coming in. There's no reservations for the deli. Oh, we got 30 at 8 o'clock or something, you know? So it's a big guessing game, and the guessing game is based on experience, and it's based on the day. I mean, obviously, I know on Saturday I'm going to have more people show up than on a Monday, so you have to get ready. It's like Saturday, Super Bowl Sunday in the restaurant business. You know, it's the day of the big game, you know. Friday can be, you know, pretty busy also. Why? Because everybody's off Saturday. Sunday is generally an older crowd for whatever reason. You know, they come out on Sundays early for dinner. There's usually specials and stuff going on, you know, that people take advantage of. But it's an interesting thing. And, you know, the funny part about being a chef is that if you run out of stuff, you look like an idiot, right? Mm-hmm. If you have too much, now you got a problem, because you got to get rid of it. You look like an idiot.
You have the problem, but yeah. The client, the customers, right. The patrons in the restaurant don't see that, and they don't see your pain.
Yeah. Now, if you get it just right, everybody goes, well, isn't that what you were supposed to do? You know, kind of thing. So you don't get a lot of credit for nailing it, you know. And you can nail it. I mean, you know, you get to the point where, I mean, I'm pretty good with the buffet thing. You know, I know when, you know, most of the people are through the buffet. I've seen what they're, the items that they're going for, you know, and what happens with a lot of these, like, especially in the club where I'm spending a lot of time now, is that the waiters and the managers are so used to this abundanza, this, you know, like food everywhere thing, which is why most of the clubs lose money, that, you know, at the end of the buffet, let's say, you know, you open a buffet at 6, by 7 o'clock, most of the people are through it, right? So let's say you're down to a half a tray of, you know, ribs or chicken or whatever you're serving, you know, all of a sudden they'll run into the kitchen. We need more chicken. We need more chicken. Panic starts, right? The guy in the kitchen can't see what's going on. So he gives you a full tray of chicken. You know what I mean? Comes out and they put it in the thing and you wind up throwing it away or giving it to the help because everybody's already been through. You know, so you have to have that restraint to some degree. And it's kind of funny with buffets because, and anybody who's cooked at home knows this, that everybody hits the buffet at the same time in the beginning generally, right? And you start to see stuff running down real quickly. It's like past hors d'oeuvres at a wedding. You know, you send out the first 20 trays and it comes back empty and you, oh my God. And I'll still do it. I'll start to panic. I'm like, geez, I better get another something on the fire or whatever. I get, you know, give me more chicken. You start getting more chicken ready, whatever. And, you know, you don't need it, you know, just because it dissipates really quickly. the energy on the buffet line, you know. So I kind of now, I kind of count, make a mental note of how many people have been through. You know, not like 1, 2, 3, but... You know, okay, there's 10 through, there's 15, there's 25 through, there's 80. So I know if I have a buffet for 100 people and 80 have been through, I don't need to replenish the entire thing.
But that just makes me wonder and realize how complicated things are. So if you go to a catered affair and there's past appetizers during the cocktail hour,
right?
You want to appease everybody up front when the stuff is coming out.
Yeah.
But I guess the real... logical plan of the kitchen would be to ration what goes out and what period so that, you know, at the end of the cocktail hour, if you get there late, you still get to take advantage of what's been there rather than, you know, them passing cucumbers at the end.
Yeah. You want some inside information on that?
Sure.
Okay. Now, if anybody hears this and they quote me, I'm going to say you lied, right? I had nothing. You didn't hear this from me. But what we do is I can control what people do with the appetizers by how I put them out and when I put them. And so what will happen is in the beginning, I tend to flood the area with, flood the room with, hors d'oeuvres, right? So I'll send, let's say, for a party of 100, I'll send 5 or 6 servers out at a time with platters of food, right? And they usually come back empty, and I'll do it again. And as I start to run down what I have in the kitchen, I'll start to send them out a little less frequently, and then depending on how much I have, less and less frequently. And it kind of coincides with the fact that at some point people have had enough, you know, I'm bored with the hors d'oeuvres already. I've had 3 or 4, you know, let's get on to the, you know, main part of the wedding or the party. And it's funny because I find that, you know, all the rage now is to extend the cocktail hour to 1.5 hours.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Which is a huge mistake, and I'll tell you why. I've done a lot of weddings, right? So I'm speaking from experience here. And I always counsel brides, and I always, because, you know, everybody's wedding, they want it to be the wedding of the century. And I get it, you know, it's your special day. It's only going to happen 2 or 3 times in your life. So what happens is they make this extravaganza and they want to extend the happy hour or the cocktail hour to 1.5 hours. Excuse me. By 45 minutes, everybody's kind of bored with it. And unless you're going to do just a continuing cocktail party, which is a fun way to do a wedding, you know, you're passing through the whole thing and stations and stuff like that, where it's not that formal, it's a little more casual. Those are a lot of fun. But if you're going to go in for a main dinner, 1 hour is plenty. You know, everybody's about had it. Nobody wants another piece of cheese. I can't take another hot dog and a blanket, you know. I just want to get into the wedding and get this. Because most people just who go to weddings just want it to be over with, honestly. You know, the patrons, you know, the people who get married, they want it to last forever. You know, they want the night to keep going and going and going. And they have, you know, food trucks out there at midnight and they have an after party and they just don't want it to end. Most of the guests want it to end. Trust me. You know, they just want to go home and go to bed.
Let me ask you this. It's more at a business event. Well, I guess for me at least. And I'm the bad person. So I usually strategically place myself where the
right outside the kitchen
servers
door.
Are coming out.
Yeah, of course.
Now, not at a wedding or a social type thing, more at a business thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, do you actually school your staff on how to deal with people like me that strategically
attack them? Yeah, we take different routes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes if I have a real pain in the rear end like you, what I'll do is I'll distract you. What's he eating? He loves the lamb racks. All right. Take the lamb racks out there, pass him, and just walk slowly to the left or the right so you will follow her with the lamb racks. And then I can send the rest of the stuff out. See, I'm like General MacArthur in there. You know, I'm basically answering an invasion. You know, I have this invasion of people coming.
Well,
I have to generate a response, you know. So I have to figure out ways to deal with difficult customers. Kind of like a guy like Stu who positions himself right outside the kitchen door and distract them in some way and get them out of the way. At the Beard House, you know, I've done several dinners at the James Beard House, which is an interesting thing. It's like, it's supposedly an honor, and I guess it is. It's like, you know, musicians when they play Carnegie Hall, chefs who cook at the Beard House. So I've done several dinners there, and there's a couple of Beard House regulars who are experts at this. And they position themselves because it's a very small kitchen, and there's only one way to get out and into the kitchen. And the Beard regulars know that. So they position themselves there like bluefish on a school of mackerel, you know what I mean? And they spearfish every hors d'oeuvre that comes out. And it's almost impossible, unless you hop over the counter with a tray of hors d'oeuvres, to get past these people into the main dining room. But, you know, like I said, we've devised ways to kind of get around that and, you know, get people to, you know, kind of move out of the way so we can get the rest of the hors d'oeuvres out. It's funny. It's kind of like there's a psychology there, you know, somewhere. And if I thought about it long enough, I could probably come up with a reason. But the bottom line is it's just, for me, it's kind of fun to manage, you know, what goes out and what people are eating. And it's funny because you see certain hors d'oeuvres work better than others. And, you know, like pigs in a blanket, no matter how many high-end weddings I do, we always include pigs in a blanket. Why, you may ask?
It's go ahead, ask me. Very popular.
Ask me why.
Why?
It's funny you should ask. Because it's very popular. Who doesn't like a hot dog? It's fat and salt. Everybody loves those, right? And I can send out foie gras this and truffle that and all the other stuff, you know, that goes out to some of these cocktail parties and stuff. And the guy who takes the pigs in a blanket out comes back looking like he was just molested, you know.
So let me ask you: with pigs in the blanket, there actually over the years are different ways of preparing and serving that item.
Yes.
There's obviously the traditional hot dog wrapped with like dough.
Yes.
The mini hot dogs.
Uh-huh.
Those most of the time come out overcooked. And then there's also sometimes I see today people are using either a larger hot dog and then slicing them
right. And
having it come out that way.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Most people, when they serve pigs in a blanket, they buy them frozen and they put them on a tray and they put them in the oven and they take them out. Right. Problem with that is they put them in frozen, so it takes a little longer for the puff pastry to puff and the hot dogs on the ends get burnt. The inside's usually okay, but the outsides get black. You know, my Aunt Pearl, who was from Liverpool, where my mother's from, was maybe the second worst cook in the United States for a long time, right? Two things she did well. She made hot chocolate for me with little mini marshmallows, which I thought was genius when I was seven, right? And she used to make the best pigs in a blanket ever, and she would take those mini hot dogs, and she would take the Pillsbury dough, and whack the thing, you know, and then wrap them with those. And she had a boat. We used to go out on a boat, and she'd bring these with them, eat them, you know. homemade, you know, they were great. The other thing we do sometimes, we had a lady that came in. She goes, you know, I want pigs in a blanket, but I don't want those little ones. I want big ones. I want big, fat ones, you know. And I'm thinking, wow, she's kind of uppity about her piggies here, you know. This woman's got a, you know, kind of. So we did, you know, and it was fine, you know. They taste better, you know, the hot dogs, the bigger hot dogs, you know, like the was a Hebrew National or whatever, you know.
And they can also be sausage, right?
You can make sausage, but I think most people want the, you know, it's kind of, there's something about the mustard too, you know, with the hot dog. It's familiar. Everybody knows it, you know. And I kind of like those better, the thicker ones wrapped, because we'll wrap them in puff pastry at the place.
Well, Tom, as you can only do, when we had a holiday party at Jewel a couple of years ago, you had some crazy thing like Wagyu beef hot dogs or something.
Yeah, you can get, I mean, it's kind of an indulgence that I don't know if it makes all that much of a difference, but from a marketing standpoint, that's what it is. And you know, when you listen to the recently passed away Anthony Bourdain, he would kind of, he had a bunch of disdain for Wagyu this. He thought it was just this ridiculous thing that people like to spend money on, which is true to some degree, especially when it's in hamburgers and hot dogs. If it's a steak, it's a different story, and I get his point, because the marbling is completely different than a regular steak. But, you know, when it's ground up into a hamburger or hot dogs, it doesn't really make big, well, that, a big difference. Well,
that's a good... Stu Leonard's is on my mind today. When I go into Stu Leonard's to shop and I see their prepared meatloaf,
right,
and they'll have a filet mignon meatloaf,
uh-huh,
or they'll have filet mignon burgers.
Yeah.
Nothing against Stu Leonard's, but is it worth the investment for filet mignon in a ground meat product?
Well, I mean, strictly speaking from a financial point, I don't think you'd know the difference. The problem with filet mignon burgers is you have to add fat to them because there's not enough fat in the filet mignon to make a good hamburger. You need about, you know, between 15 to 20% fat in a burger to make the burger palatable. So there's not 15 to 20% fat in filet mignon. Filet mignon is very lean. The reason they're making filet mignon burgers is because they don't know what else to do with the tail. So what happens is when you get a filet mignon, it's like they're usually about, like, say, a foot and a half to 2 feet long, you know, and you have that thick end where you see those nice round steaks are cut out. As you get to the end of the filet, it flattens out into this tail, and you can't really cut a filet mignon out of that because it would be like 2 inches wide, you know. So you have to come up with something to do with the tails. Or now, from standpoint, here's some insider information for anybody who really cares about this stuff, and presumably we have two or three people that care about this because they're listening. Insider information on this is, you know, there's two ways to buy filet mignons in a restaurant. You can have them cut to order to a certain specific size. I can say, hey, listen, I need, you know, 48 filets that are 10 ounces, and I can get them cut and cryovac and ready to go. That's pretty expensive. That's probably, let's say, $25, $28 a pound. Or I can get the whole filet, which is probably more like $15 a pound, $16 a pound, cut it myself. But you have cutting loss, you know. So what do you do with the rest of the filet mignon? Well, you know, some people make hamburgers like Stu Leonard. I prefer to use it in things like chili or you know, bolognese sauce or things of that nature. I can even make some beef stew out of that if I get the chunks big enough. But that's the key to kind of making money with the rest of the filet mignon.
So you talk about buying the whole, what do you call it, filet of beef?
Yeah, it's really, technically it's called a tenderloin. But people think of tenderloin, they think of that pink meat that, you know, that comes around every once in a year.
So every so often, when we're down in Florida and we've got a large group, Kerry and I will get a filet,
yeah,
of beef.
Whole filet mignon.
And believe it or not, at Costco, they seem to have decent meat. And it's trimmed nice. But she'll cook it up, but she'll bastardize it, in my mind, because
I wouldn't mention that if I were you.
Well, I hope she's not listening.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But
that's a bold
I like
move.
That the way you say you cut it into, you know, 2-inch steaks or whatever.
Yeah.
She'll make it like roast beef. You know, she'll slice, you know, she'll cut it.
Well, that's okay. I mean, you know.
But then you get to use the whole thing without any issues.
Well, as long as you have a guy like you around, because you like well-done meat. So the tail end is going to be more well-done, obviously, than the thicker, you know, other end. You know, that's. See, I've done, you know, for weddings, I'll roast the whole filet, but I'll trim off that end first, you know. So I'll have 2/3 of a filet, you know, that I'm roasting off. And let's say I'll roast off 10 or 20, or how many people I have, and then slice that. And that's two reasons for that. One is presentation. It looks a lot better, I think, laid out like that with a nice medium rare, in your case, a nice medium well, right? And then, you know, I can decorate the plate. If I just put a hunk of meat there, it's fine, but it just doesn't look the same. Two is it's more economical. I can get more out of a filet mignon. I can serve more people slicing it like that than chunking it into steaks. So there's two reasons for that, you know. And it's okay to make money. We're allowed, you know, not much, but we're allowed.
So as we said at the beginning of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about Christmas. And I have this fantasy. If somebody was able to hire Tom Shawdell to prepare their holiday meal and be chef in their kitchen, and would prepare the menu and just orchestrate the whole evening, what that might be. But I guess we should take a break.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hear from our friends at Freshfin Gourmet. And then I'd really like to get into that. That's like a real fantasy.
Tom All right, Shardell, let's do
come
it.
Into your house.
There you go.
For Christmas Eve.
All right. We'll be back.
Attention seafood lovers. Introducing FreshFinGourmet.com. Now you can enjoy specialty seafood delivered directly to your door. Their seafood products are sourced from mineral-rich waters across the globe and are responsibly harvested. Family-owned and operated by the Gulo family, who began their legacy in the food business from their personal love for seafood. The holidays are coming. Order all the delicacies for the Night of Seven Fishes. You can order sushi-grade octopus, squid, Chilean sea bass, wild Dover sole filet, and much more. They also offer premium meat, imported Sicilian desserts, and delicious pasta. Get the fastest delivery and shipping in the business. And their attention to detail in both packing and shipping assures freshness and quality. Go to FreshFinGourmet.com and see the vast array of choices for your special meal creation. That's Fresh, F-I-N, Gourmet.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shardell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
All right. Well, you know, to bring chefs into your house can be an expensive proposition for a couple of reasons. Number one is presumably the guy you're bringing in has some knowledge, you know, and has a reputation or whatever, a catering thing, a business, whatever. And that has to be, you know, compensated for. And number two, it's more than a little bit of a pain in the rear end to, you know, take your show on the road. It's there's, you know, a lot involved. There's the transportation, there's the loading, the unloading. You know.
And that's something that most people don't understand in all aspects of business, be it your lawn sprinkler repair service, the guy that's coming to fix your air conditioner, you know. They, you know, the average person goes, wow, you know, they spent 20 minutes in my house and I got $200 bill.
Yeah.
But they forget that, first of all, there's a cost of inventorying parts.
Sure.
The transportation. We all know how expensive gas is. And the same thing with a chef. You know, there's time, I assume, and you'll get into it, planning and shopping and executing. And then there's even the cleanup. And then I guess if you're supplying the settings.
Yeah. Well, to digress for a second, and digressing is what we do here.
We just digress from a digression.
Yes, yes. So I once had a person, you know, there's this thing about bringing your own dessert, like a cake, into the restaurant. It's like, yeah okay, I get it. It's like, you know, corkage fee for wine or whatever. So I told this woman it was a $3 cake cutting fee. You know what she told me? I'll cut the cake myself. I said, well, that's convenient, but what about the other parts? What are you talking about? I said, well, the cake cutting fee just isn't for cutting the cake. It's cutting the cake, serving the cake, washing the dishes, supplying the dishes, washing the silverware, supplying the dishes, the silverware, supplying the electricity that washes the dishes in the dishwashing machine, and paying a dishwasher. You know, I mean, I don't think $3 is a lot of money. There's a lot involved in stuff like that. You know. Anyway. Should we digress back?
I guess we should get back into my fantasy.
All right, your fantasy, which is an odd one. You know, most guys have different fantasies, but yours is about me coming to the house and cooking.
I love to entertain and have friends over and really enjoy the old movies where, again, there were dinner parties. And I don't see it that way anymore.
No, most people don't want to mess up the house. You know, I can't imagine inviting 30 people over to mess up my house and then thanking them for coming and cleaning up. But anyway, if you want to get a professional into your house, first, there's a couple of things you should do. Research, you know, your options. You know, research who you want to bring in, you know, what they've done before. Have you tasted their food? If it's a restaurant guy, that's easier. Caterers, a little tougher. But they'll go over a menu. Two is choose a menu that that you're going to like. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, the food's, you know, what it is. And then, you know, kind of stay out of the way. I mean, and I don't mean that in a flippant way. I just mean that, you know, the problem with when I've gone to you know, people's houses to cook, they used to auction me off like chattel at these fundraisers to come into your house and cook. And they would get, you know, a lot of money, you know, for the charity. And I didn't mind doing it. But it's difficult because everybody wants to be in the kitchen with you when you're cooking. And most home kitchens can't accommodate like 20 people. So you kind of, excuse me, sorry, can you excuse, get out of it? Can you move? I'm sorry, I'm just, give me a second, kind of thing. And they're trying to talk to you about all this stuff as it's going on, which is very nice. I mean, I get it, you know, and people are curious and it's, you know, they don't get to see a pro in action kind of thing, you know. But there is this, you know, I got to get this out thing, you know. So you kind of ride in the, you know, the rails between, you know, trying to accommodate everybody's questions and kind of concentrate on what you're doing so you're not going to overcook the filet mignon, you know. So it's a little bit of a, from the chef's standpoint, it's a little bit of a high wire act. You know, I did one dinner with Paul Magro from the Magro Foundation, and they auctioned me off, and it was, I guess it was 12 or 15 people. And when they were auctioning me off, in order to raise the price, I was doing the auction. I said, you know, I'll bring Paul in as my sous chef, you know, Paul Magro. And so we went from $2,500 to $3,000. And I said, you know, if I can get $3,600 for this, I'll even bring a guitar and I'll play a set afterwards, you know. So this thing devolved into this sing-along around the dinner table thing. It was hilarious. You know, it was great. And, you know, we were playing older songs like Hang On Sloopy, you know, because it was an older crowd, you know. And then younger stuff, it was doing some like Pearl Jam or whatever. But it was a lot of fun. It was a good time. But at the end of the day, you know, I got there at 3 o'clock. I left at 2 in the morning.
I'm thinking this through. It's got to be tough because when you – I've been fortunate to see you in action at the club cooking.
Right.
And it's amazing because everything is there to your beck and call.
Uh-huh.
And there's just nothing missing. I assume when you go and take over somebody's kitchen, first of all, there's a familiarity that's missing.
Yeah.
And then either you have to bring, you know, like all the spices or the ingredients.
Yeah.
Well, not and the basic ingredients, you know, if you need fish to cook a fish dish, you need meat to that's okay. But I'm just sitting here saying, wow, if you need salt and I only have traditional salt and not the kosher salt that you wanted to prepare the food with,
right?
It's just that much more involved.
Yeah, well, I bring all of that stuff. I make sure I bring all of that stuff. And you know, when I get there, the first thing I do is let me see the area. And you know, I've done thousands of these things, so I'll make a mental note of where I have to put what and, you know, how many of this I need, the pots, pans, whatever. I'll ask where they are, maybe trays if I need a plates, whatever, you know.
So now, I have to rein you in. This is my fantasy. So you're there for
And it's a strange one, by the way.
Yes, but you're there for Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So let's continue in that theme. What special things you might need? I mean, for all I know, you need food dye because you're going to make red and white different things or whatever.
No, I think the first thing I would do is to see if they wanted a specialty cocktail sometimes, you know, for like an eggnog martini or, you know, peppermint martini or something like that, some kind of celebratory, you know, drink. Most people don't want to do that or maybe want to have it available, but they still want wine or whatever. And generally they have their own liquor cabinet things going on, you know, which is cool. Second thing is the menu. I mean, you know, you're going to have, usually for those dinners, if it's like 8 or 10 people, there's one entree. And in case there's a vegetarian, you know, you have stuff to accommodate that. Sometimes people want a choice, but it's kind of a lot to ask for a house party.
But again, this is Christmas Eve.
And it's your fantasy.
And it's my fantasy. And this thing with the 7 fishes.
Well, that's a whole different deal. I mean, I thought we were doing Christmas Day,
but right, see, I confused.
Right, let's do 7 fishes. All right, let's focus.
I'm doing Confucius.
Can we focus, please? All right. So the 7 fishes. First of all, you got to pick them, right? You got to come up with 7. So generally, there's clams involved. There's scallops involved. There's, you know, crab meat. Usually, as the Italians would say, calamari involved. And then you can pick out a couple others. You can pick out a fin fish. you know, sort of like flounder or fluke this time of year, tuna, salmon, whatever. And then you got two more, mussels are a good one, you know, and oysters are a good one. So the thing to do is to pick out the seven, and then how are we going to handle it? Well, there's one way, especially if you're doing a house party, to handle a whole bunch at once is like a seafood salad, a cold, like, you know, kind of Italian coastal seafood salad, which would include, let's say, calamari, mussels, scungili, which is conch for people who don't know that. Scallop, shrimp, you know. So you got five or six of the fish.
What is right the conch?
Conch is scungili. Oh. You know that shell that you hold to your ear and you hear that? That's scungili, you know. Oh. And they're very tough. That, you know, when you take it out, you either have to eat them almost like raw, sliced really thin, or if you're going to cook them, you got to cook them for like months, you know what I mean, and tenderize them. You know, the conch, a lot of times what they'll do down in the Caribbean is they'll take and they'll beat it almost like it's a veal cutlet, you know, and tenderize it that way, you know. But you can kill, like I said, five or six, even seven of the fishes just with a seafood salad. And then you could do, you know, I would do that because that would take care of a lot of the number. And then, you know, something like baked clams, which is kind of a traditional Italian or Little Italy kind of thing. A nice pasta with seafood in the pasta with like a black pasta with calamari, scallops, some crab meat, maybe some lobster or separate lobster dish. So I would, you know, talk to the person whose fantasy this is. I would go to Stu and say, listen, this is what I'm thinking. You know, how, you know, are there any dietary restrictions? Are there any, you know, things that people really want or don't want? And then I would fill in around that. I would fill in around, you know, because you're going to have, you know, baked clams is an appetizer-ish kind of dish. You know, the seafood salad is a salad-y kind of thing. So you're going to have that covered.
So what's the actual recipe that you suggest for the seafood salad?
Well, I like to make it with like sort of a lemony vinaigrette. So I would take, you know, whatever seafood I'm going to use. Let's say I'm going to use, I like to use shellfish in this. So shrimp would be a big part of it. Calamari would be a big part of it. Squid, scungili would be a big part of it. Mussels, poached mussels would be a big part of it. What else would I have in there? Crab meat would be a part of it. And then what I like to do is I like to take red and yellow peppers and red onions and slice them very thinly and use them in there with some celery.
Why, you know, the celery? I'm not.
Celery gives it a texture. It's a crunch.
I don't like. It's funny. I like crunch, but I don't like celery.
All right. It's your fantasy. So let's leave the celery out.
No. It seems to be a very traditional
thing.
You want
it back in now?
And again, just like you said, there always seems to be some finely diced peppers in there, some onions.
Yeah, well, it's textural. I mean, the peppers I use for color. So you got red, yellow, and green peppers, right? The onions I use a little bit for flavor, you know, with some fresh basil. And the celery is for texture. So you have the whole thing going on. You know, all that seafood is going to be soft and kind of pliable, you know, provided you don't overcook it.
So I like the scungili. I mean, does it actually have an interesting taste? I mean, I just somehow think of just hard to chew.
Well, yeah, it can be rubbery. You know, you got to handle it right. You know, it's got to be cooked down. But yeah, it's got a taste. It's like shrimp. I mean, you know, shrimp, does it really have a big taste? If it tasted so good, you wouldn't be putting ketchup on it, you know, horseradish or whatever it is, lemon. So all of that together, you know, I would toss with like a lemony vinaigrette. And when I make a lemon vinaigrette, I always cut the acid. There was, you know, I'll use lemon juice and I'll also use a little white balsamic vinegar so it's not too lemony. And also some lemon zest in there, you know, zest the outside of the lemon with a little grater. You want that in there. And a real good extra virgin olive oil. You don't want to skimp on the olive oil on a great seafood salad like that. And generally, it's two-thirds olive oil to one-third acid. So if you're going to make a cup of it, you need two-thirds of a cup of olive oil and a third of a cup of half and half white balsamic vinegar and lemon juice.
White balsamic?
Yeah. That plays into a lot of my vinaigrettes. I think it's probably the best vinegar to use in vinaigrettes, unless you're going to go heavier like sherry vinegar with walnut oil if you use different nut oils, you know, it requires, I think, a, you know, a stronger vinegar. But we're digressing again. So we're back to the seafood salad. And then that serve, I like to put lemon slices right in the seafood salad for a couple of reasons. I think you can eat lemon slices, you know, if they're thin enough. I also think they give a nice color in there and a little bit more flavor. And then fresh basil. You can put a nice little, you know, chop some in there, but also put a nice little fresh basil leaf or a like a basil bouquet on top. And you have a beautiful little seafood salad that who isn't going to... I also like to put a little tomato in there, too, just to tell you the truth. Take a little cherry tomato and cut it in half and incorporate that in because it gives a nice little red color.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So that would be my classic, you know, kind of Italian coastal seafood salad. Now, baked clams are another, you know, fun thing to serve on the Feast of the Seven Fishes. And they're really easy to make. And the way I make the topping is I'll take, and this isn't like a recipe thing. I can give you an idea, but I make such large quantities, it's hard to break down. But I start with panko breadcrumbs. You can use any kind of breadcrumbs. But I wouldn't use seasoned. I don't like seasoned breadcrumbs, like the Four C's, stuff like that. I just don't like the way they're seasoned. And, you know, I think if you do it yourself, you're better off. So I take them in like a food processor. Let's say you're going to put a cup. Of breadcrumbs in there, right? Plain breadcrumbs. And then I would put probably maybe a third of a cup of grated Romano cheese. Really? Romano pecorino cheese. I would put like 2 teaspoons of paprika in there. And I would put 2 teaspoons of dried oregano in there. And probably a teaspoon of salt in there. And then buzz that down in the food processor until you get it all incorporated, right? And then what you want to do is you want to take a little extra virgin olive oil and slowly drizzle it in until the crumbs become a little moistened, right? So once the crumbs are moistened, you got them, and you're going to take them, you're going to open the clam, and you're going to separate the clam from the bottom of the shell. You don't want to leave that attached because you'll never get it out once it's cooked. And you're going to take that olive oil moistened breadcrumb mixture and just take a spoon and mound it over the top of the clam so it looks like a whole clam. You know, you got a good breadcrumbs there. And then what I do is I take them and I put more pecorino romano on them. And a little bit of melted butter and a little bit of white wine or water in the bottom of the pan. And just bake them in the oven until you get a little bit of a nice browning, you know, on the top. And you're good to go. Just take them off and watch them disappear.
Well, while I go to the oven to take those out, we're going to have to take a break.
All right, well, let's take a break. We'll sell some commercial time here. And we'll come back and we'll continue.
Attention seafood lovers. Introducing FreshFinGourmet.com. Now you can enjoy specialty seafood delivered directly to your door. Their seafood products are sourced from mineral-rich waters across the globe and are responsibly harvested. Family-owned and operated by the Gulo family, who began their legacy in the food business from their personal love for seafood. The holidays are coming. Order all the delicacies for the Night of Seven Fishes. You can order sushi-grade octopus, squid, Chilean sea bass, wild Dover sole filet, and much more. They also offer premium meat, imported Sicilian desserts, and delicious pasta. Get the fastest delivery and shipping in the business. And their attention to detail in both packing and shipping assures freshness and quality. Go to FreshFinGourmet.com and see the vast array of choices for your special meal creation. That's Fresh, F-I-N, Gourmet.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM. Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
All right, so continuing with the Feast of the Seven Fishes. Since we're talking about an Italian tradition, it would be sacrilegious not to have a pasta in there, right?
So I have to interrupt. So listening to our sponsor, FreshFinGourmet.com's radio spot that just ran, I was not familiar that they have desserts and pasta.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they actually have some interesting pastas. There's like, I mean, obviously there's rigatoni and spaghetti and fettuccine.
Yeah.
But there's something called a ballerina pasta. So you really should go to FreshFinGourmet.com and not only the fresh fish, but check out the desserts and the pasta selection.
The ballerina pie, is it shaped like a tutu or something?
It really is.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's like wagon wheels, you know?
I grew up on those. Yeah. I used to get the Cowboys and Indians.
Not good for you. Anyway, so taking a pasta of your choice, whether it's ballerina or something more traditional, like wagon wheels, my choice would be squid ink pasta. Which is a black pasta made with the cuttlefish ink. For two reasons. One, there's a very, 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 very subtle flavor there that I find alluring. And it's not enough to turn off people who don't like seafood or fish or, you know, queasy about the ink part. And if not, you can, you know, you can eschew that and just, you know, go with regular linguine or whatever.
But does the ink really put off much of a flavor? Or that's
what I said. It's very subtle and... There's something about the color that I love. But I would just make a kind of a traditional sort of Fra Diablo-ish sauce for lack of a better name. And how I would do that would be, let's have some poached lobster ready. You know, you can take, let's say, a one-pound lobster, and you boil it for about 8 minutes or so, and then plunge it into ice water, and then open it up and remove the meat, so you have the meat off to the side. I would have a little raw calamari cut into rings. I would have some shrimp available, maybe, let's say, 21, 20. What I do is I'll start, it's pretty much what you need. And then what I do is I'll start with a little bit of, if you like, onion. If not, you can leave that out. But slivered garlic would be real good. And I would saute that in some oil until it started to get a little bit of a color, like a beigey brown, you know. And then... And you're going to add a little white wine, something that you would drink, a Pinot Grigio, a little Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, something along those lines. And you're going to put that in the pan, and you're going to let that reduce by about two-thirds. So what does that mean? That means you have a volume. Let's say you put in a cup. You're going to reduce that down until it's a third of a cup. And then you're going to add your marinara tomato sauce to that. All right, once you get that in, then you're going to add your seafood. And then it's a question of some, I use some fresh basil and a little bit of fresh thyme in there and just toss that until it's all warm through. Take your pasta, your squid ink or whatever, fresh and or dried. They both work real well. If you have squid ink, it's going to be fresh. There's no dried that I know of. So you use the fresh squid ink. And you have to remember that fresh pasta takes very little time to cook, 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes or whatever, where regular pasta can take 8 to 12, depending on the shape. And then just what you're going to do is you're going to take that pasta, drain it when it's done, and don't rinse it. People sometimes try and rinse their pasta in water. You want that starch on there. And you're just going to drain that and put it into your sauce and let that reduce. Now, if the sauce gets a little too thick, you can add a little bit of that pasta water to thin it out. You know, if not, you're fine. And make sure when you cook your pasta, you're cooking it in salted water. Now, most people don't add enough salt. They put a pinch of salt in there. It's a waste of time. If you're going to put a pinch of salt in, just save the money, you know. It should taste like seawater. Your pasta water should taste like seawater. It should be very, very salty. And that's going to give your pasta a little more flavor. So when I teach young cooks how to season, I teach them how to season at every level. You'll sometimes have 2 or 3, 4 components in a dish. Each one has to be seasoned on its own separately. I don't tell them to wait until all 4 get into the same pot and give it a shot, you know. Just season as you go and make sure each one is seasoned separately.
So I got to give you some insight into my life. I have now gone from cooking my spaghetti on the stove,
right,
in a pot of boiling water.
I'm scared.
To heating up water in the microwave.
Oh.
And I usually use angel hair pasta.
Uh-huh.
And I can have pasta to eat in like, it takes like 3 minutes to boil. And like less than 3 minutes to cook. So within 5 minutes, I can have my pasta from the microwave. Then the other thing that's going to continue to separate you from me is I don't mix in the sauce. I put it on the top. And
any particular reason?
I like the sauce.
But you don't like it when it's with the pasta? You like it?
Well,
why don't you just put it in a bowl and use a spoon?
Essentially, I dip the pasta in the sauce because if the sauce is on top and I'm twirling from the bottom, I have to dip.
I don't know if I can be your friend anymore.
But see, you've cultured me. At least I know I'm strange.
Oh, that's great. My advice would be, Stu's fantasy notwithstanding, is to toss your pasta when you get it in the sauce. Now, if you want to put it on top, go ahead, you know, but eventually you're going to have to mix it in. So the reason that we do what we do is because we want all the pasta to be kind of coated equally and, you know, whatever. I mean, so every bite is the same amount.
Well, the problem with my serving technique is I have to go back for additional sauce where it's all done when you do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you can always serve a gravy boat, I guess, for lack of a better term, of sauce on the side, you know, to put on the top. Listen, however you do it, you do it. It's like I said, I tell people, drink the wine you like, eat it the way you want. You know, it's your dinner and your pleasure, so go get them. But anyway, that's the way I would do it. And you know, pasta to me is that ultimate comfort food. It just doesn't get any better than pasta, you know. When you're just looking for that rib-tickling, you know, kind of, you know, sort of satisfying meal, pasta always, you know, hits the spot. Now, if you have carbo issues or stuff like that, you know, the great part about eating pasta in Italy is they don't give you 3 pounds. You know what I mean? You get a portion the size of your fist, and they eat pasta with every meal, and there's not an overweight problem over there. You burn it right off, you know? So if you behave yourself, you know, you can use pasta as a prelude to any dinner.
So and then I was just going to reach out to our listeners. I believe they know at this point that they can communicate with us and exchange ideas and thoughts.
Especially for Christmas stuff, right?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
By sending an email to us at fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. We have a couple of regulars that every Sunday write to us, and we really do appreciate it.
Absolutely.
If we don't respond immediately, understand that we do share the emails with each other.
Yeah.
And again, it's really interesting to see your reactions or to hear your reactions to content on the show. This week, I'd love, since we're talking about the holiday and Christmas Eve, we'd love to hear about a special year, a special season that you had, or a special food. Maybe it was just the fact that, like this year, we're beginning to get together again.
Yeah.
I know my family was able to get together for Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. We really haven't seen each other together in almost 2 years. We got together outdoors last summer, the summer before, but it just, the pandemic really has interrupted everything.
Totally.
So it was really nice to have all my children, my grandchildren, my mom, my sister together, and we had a nice Hanukkah dinner. But again, please, our listeners, fire@whli.com. You can send us recipes, pictures, share a memory. We'd love to hear. It's all about family, and you are our family.
And especially the recipe angle, you know, because being the restaurant beast that I am, I mean, it's my whole life. I'm constantly searching for the missing note, the better way, and you can learn a lot from people. I mean, you don't have to be a professional, and you don't have to be insecure about it. I read them all, and you know, I'm happy to steal something that's really cool and put it into my repertoire. So
that's interesting you say that, Tom. So in today's world, technology, more availability of food, already prepared food maybe a little bit. What astonishes you or amazes you or makes your life easier just in what's available today as compared to in the old days? Is there a type of cooking pan that makes things easier, or does the food processor, you know, something like that?
Yeah, well, the equipment is different. You know, I have a commercial steamer at the club, which, you know, cuts down a lot of time for me with certain items, you know. So that's good. And just tools in general, you know, the Robocoup, what do they call the food processors? The
Cuisinart.
Yeah, the Cuisinart food processor. It's like that on steroids. It's a commercial thing.
Really?
It's much bigger and it's much more powerful, you know. Things like that, and, you know, that help us along the way making some things that, you know, that we normally took a while to chop.
I always get a kick going into, pizzeria and going in the back, and if they make their own dough, these machines that I'm going to describe have been there forever.
Oh yeah,
but the machine that needs the dough.
Yeah, the mixer. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's the coolest thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We have a lot of things that, you know, are available to us in commercial kitchens that you don't have in the home. I'm a disaster in the home. I'm you couldn't pay me to cook in a kitchen home. I had an interesting thing happen. You know, I was at Cool Fish one night. It was a Friday night, and Mike Doria was playing. You know, Mike's a great guitar player, right? And Steve Vai walks in with his brother. And so his brother was busting his chops about playing. He goes, come on, Steve, get up there and play a song. He says, no, I'm not really, you know, I don't want to, Roger, don't bother me, you know. No, come on, Steve. You know, and Roger's really being insistent that Steve went up and played a tune. And Steven said to him, listen, Roger, I'm an electric guitar innovator. That's what I do. I don't play, you know, gigs on acoustic guitars in restaurants on Fridays. You know, I get it. He goes, I hope so. I said, yeah. I'm the same way. I'm a professional cook in a professional kitchen. I don't do somebody's home. I slam the oven door with my foot. You know, I'm throwing pots and pans in the sink. You know, the stuff that I do normally at work doesn't work in the home kitchen. It doesn't translate, you know. So, again, getting back to, you know, what makes it easier, my life easier, the commerciality of the ovens. You know, I have ovens that, you know, the pizza oven gets to 900 degrees. You know, you don't have a 900-degree oven in your house. You know, this is why steakhouses make better steaks than you make at home, because they have the firepower, you know. Those grills are 1,100, 1,200 degrees. And you can't get the same char on a steak at home, even if you're cooking outside. So it's the equipment that allows us to do what we do and the volume that we do it. And the space, you know, it's nice to have some area, you know. Although, you know, Amano, I was cooking in Amano last Sunday. We had that wine dinner in Mono's kitchen is a little bigger than this studio, you know. It's small, but it's well equipped. So you know, even though it doesn't have a lot of room, it's got a lot of stuff there that, you know, makes our life easier and makes it able to.
And I have to ask you about that dinner. One of my associates here at the radio station, Jim Cicero, was all excited about your Mono dinner that night. I forget who you paired the wine.
RGNY.
Oh yes.
Did he go? I don't know.
I don't think he made it, but he was just, you know, he goes, Stu, do you know about this? I said, we were just talking about it. But I just have to throw out something. You said the space. Well, last time Steve Vai was in town, he played the space.
He did.
In Westbury. Steve Vai is in town in 2022 on February 25th at the Paramount up in Huntington.
Yes.
And I guess we have to talk about that, because you said you might need a couple of extra tickets.
Yeah, he sent me a couple of tickets already. So,
but I think I finally might actually have a night out with you in the summer at Jones Beach coming summer. Joe Bonamassa is performing in August. Tickets, I think, go on sale this weekend. But you into Bonamassa?
I am. Yeah, he's a great player. I'm not into him on Friday and Saturday, but. You know, if it's a weekday, I can do it.
We'll have to see.
Check it out. Well, listen, I'm going to close the show while you're checking with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which is life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, and that's the important one. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we will see you next week.